Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, Red Sneaker Writers. This is episode 54, going out on September 21st, 2020. Well, this is our first podcast post-WriterCon, WriterCon 2020, our annual writers' conference. So I just want to send out a big thank you to all the many people who participated either in front of the podium or behind it, helping make this conference a success. And that includes those of you who either came or watched the conference on your computers through the streaming aspect that we added this year. We actually managed to see a 20% increase in our attendance this year, despite the fact that we're in the middle of a pandemic lockdown. I think that's a testament to you, the writing community, those of you who are writers and emerging writers, and the seriousness of your devotion to language and the writing arts. In case you're wondering, yes, of course, we're having another conference next year. We're already planning for WriterCon 2021, and this I know for certain, we will retain the streaming aspect, plus the ability to watch all the sessions after the conference online. I know many of you who listen to this podcast are in far-flung places, at least far-flung from me, and Oklahoma City, where the conference takes place. So this will enable you to be an important part of the conference, to benefit from all the aspects of the conference, despite your geographical location. I'll convey more information about WriterCon 2021 when I have it, but rest assured, we will have it, and we will stream. On this podcast, my special guest interview is with Betsy Kulikowski, who has just published her first novel, The Veritas Codex. It's the first book in a series involving an investigative television journalist who explores the strange side of things. I had the pleasure of meeting Betsy on the WriterCon cruise and couldn't be more excited to see her first book now in print. So I wanted to talk to her about that, about the process of writing and publishing and what it's like having your first book come out during the middle of a worldwide lockdown. We'll talk to Betsy, we'll have writing tips, but first, the news. A lot of interesting news coming out of the world of traditional publishing, and some from the world of online book sales and book reading, and even artificial intelligence. First up, I've reported before that Simon & Schuster was on the market, available to any of you with a spare $1.2 billion. I also reported that Penguin Random House looked like a very likely buyer. And in the past couple weeks, the CEO of Bertelsmann, the parent company of Penguin Random House, has confirmed that they are looking pretty seriously at this acquisition and presumably are in the negotiation process. The CEO said that the publishing business model is, quote, robust, the business resilient and profitable. It's a good cultural fit. End quote. He seems to be commenting not only on the intelligence of this acquisition for the company that is already the largest publishing entity in the English-speaking world, but also seems to be voicing some confidence that there is a future for traditional or print-based publishing. They've done this before, so if anybody can bring it off, they would be the one. Interestingly enough, the CEO also went on to say that he thinks there's going to be more consolidation once this pandemic is passed. Of course, we're all wondering when that is going to be. But the point seems to be that when so many are being hard hit, particularly in terms of print-based sales, there might be more companies up on the market. After the Big Five becomes Big Four, could it be 3, 2, one, and then where do we go from there? It's also interesting that we're talking about this consolidation after a period that has not been the best ever for Penguin Random House. They reported a sales decline of 1.4% for the first half of the year, as composed to the previous year, which and also profits down of nearly 8%. Now, digital sales have increased, ebooks, digital downloads of audiobooks, but everything else not so much. The one shining star in the Penguin Random House arsenal is a book you've heard me mention before, Where the Crawdads Sing by Delia Owens, is still doing extremely well for them and is still their best-selling fiction title. Speaking of traditional publishing and bookselling, we've heard from the CEO of the largest chain store, bookstore in the United States, and really the only national bookstore chain at this point, Barnes & Noble. Their relatively new CEO, James Daunt, spoke in an online seminar hosted by Book Industry Study Group. A lot of what he said was kind of old news, stuff he's been saying for at least a year, but we haven't seen happen yet. To be fair, bookstores have been closed for a good part of this year. He says he wants more input from local bookstores on what books they should stock. He's taking various measures to try and reduce returns. The bookstores need or obligation to return books for credit to the book publisher. If they don't sell the book after a certain period of time, they can return the book to the publishing house for credit, but it's a burdensome and waste-filled process. Anyway, what I found most interesting was this quote from Daunt, so listen to what he's saying. Bookstores do have to justify themselves, and I don't think we have any God-given right to exist. If we are not inspiring within our communities and able to attract customers to us, frankly, we will not exist. How is it that bookstores do justify themselves in the age of Amazon? They do so by being places in which you discover books with an enjoyment, with a pleasure, with a serendipity that is simply impossible to replicate online. End quote. Well, I hope you were able to grasp what he's saying. Even I should have done a British accent because, you know, it's James Daunt. But even without that, isn't that pretty honest? I mean, he's acknowledging that there are simpler and probably cheaper and certainly quicker ways to buy books than traveling to the local Barnes & Noble. If the chain's going to exist, it's going to be because people want to go there and not just because they like the feel of the book and they want to hold it in their hands. It has to be a destination, a pleasure place that people want to go to discover books, because there are other ways to discover and purchase books. I thought that was astoundingly honest. What he didn't explain, of course, is how he's going to create that pleasurable environment that people want to go to. Semi-related to the world of bookstores would be the world of libraries, and we had statements from David Burley from Overdrive, Overdrive being a company that distributes ebooks and audiobooks, digital audiobooks, not, you know, object-based audiobooks, to primarily libraries. And he provided some pretty useful, interesting statistics showing that library activity has, in fact, increased since the onset of the pandemic. Of course, they had obstacles, too, as many libraries were closed, but in fact, the number of new users added each week went up after initial delay when everything was in immediate lockdown and people didn't know what to do. But since late March, early April, their borrows have been ahead of pre-pandemic numbers. And even to this point, many, many, more than 6 months after the lockdown began for most people, checkouts are still trending about 60% above last year. Ebook checkouts have greatly increased and still remain high as opposed to last year. In other words, people are still reading, and not just because they have to or they don't have to go to work or work the same hours. They're choosing to. But many, many people who were opposed to ebooks before are finding they're not so bad as they thought they were once upon a time. The world is changing. He also mentioned that publishers are now making more room for direct-to-the-customer marketing. In other words, instead of spending all their money advertising related to bookstores, co-op, or product placement ads so that they can get their books into bookstores and get them displayed at the bookstores, but instead marketing direct to the customer, understanding that people don't necessarily have to have a bookstore in order to order books. So you see how these stories go hand in hand. Daunt is right. He understands that people can skip the bookstore and still enjoy their reading habit. So he's got to find a way to make people want to go there so publishers will continue to send their advertising theirs that way instead of going with the direct-to-customer marketing. One last story. This will be of interest to certainly techies and maybe everything, and this relates to a new program called Marlowe. Marlowe as in the poet or the detective, depending upon which way you go. Marlowe. It's an artificial intelligence program that will basically analyze your unpublished novel for a relatively small fee. A few years ago, a book came out. I think this was before I did the podcast, but I remember talking about it to other venues at the time. It was called The Bestseller Code by Jody Archer and Matthew Jockers. And this book purported to have done computer analysis on hundreds, if not thousands, of best-selling books to try and figure out what's the secret? How do you make a bestseller? And the thesis of the book was that there was, quote, an uncanny number of latent features that recur over and over again in best-selling books. And so the authors divined basically what I think now we would call an algorithm to read bestsellers and figure out what is the DNA of a bestseller so that you can break it down and understand it and presumably put it in your next book. Well, that algorithm has now been integrated into Marlowe, this brand new for-profit service that you can find at a website called Authors AI. One of the founders is Matthew Jockers, who is one of the authors of that previously mentioned book. Basically, anybody now, for a fee, can upload their novel manuscript, their unpublished work, and receive this algorithm-based analysis of their work, analyzing your dialogue or your balance between dialogue and narrative or your characterization, narrative beats, pacing, the plot structure. And you may be wondering, wait a minute, how is a computer going to measure that? And that is a darn good question, but they have ways. If you'd like to see this in action, visit Jane Friedman's website because she submitted two books to the service and you can read the reports they got on her website. What's interesting is it's mostly all these charts and graphs, you know, ups and down loops showing where the plot supposedly gets more exciting or more boring, or where the character's journey ebbs and flows, and stuff that, frankly, I didn't find very illuminating. You know, it's the sort of thing a computer programmer might enjoy, but I'm not sure how much an author will. They also have lists of thematic or structural elements that recur in the back, percentage-wise, like there's a lot of this, there's not so much of that. If you'd like to check out and find out what a computer program by these guys thinks of your book, you can do that. Apparently, so far, I mean, before they even opened, Marlowe, the program, read almost 1,000 titles in order to build its database of information. And now they are offering a free report to you. Yes, you Red Sneaker writers or anybody else who wants to do this. It's not as detailed as the report you get if you pay money, but the free report will surface on things like focus on things like, are you using cliches or too much dialogue or overusing adjectives and adverbs? I mean, it's sort of a plus AI version of Grammarly, I suppose. Misspellings and other kind of surface level problems that might arise. I'm reporting this as a news item, I will point out. It's not a recommendation. It's way too soon to say whether it's useful or not. didn't look useful to me, but, you know, maybe I didn't, I don't know. I just don't think it's something that I'm ever going to find useful. And I note that the two manuscripts that Jane submitted, one of the authors also said this seemed a little vague and not very useful. I mean, at the end of the day, the whole point of getting feedback is not just to have somebody break down the elements of your story in percentages or graphs, but to say, this is what you need to do to make it better. And I'm not sure that's what this AI program does yet. Of course, it's just launching, and at this point, it's not that expensive. Who knows what it might be doing in the future? Here's something that could happen in the future. You know, they're marketing this program right now to authors for obvious reasons, but what happens if other people want to get involved? What if agents decide to use it to deal with the huge number of over-the-transom submissions they get? You know, upload some of the most promising to Marlowe and see if Marlowe thinks any of them are worth taking on. Or what if publishers use it? You know, we're thinking about these 10 books. Which do you like best, Marlowe? I mean, this could become something important, and I'm not sure, even though it doesn't look very reliable to me, I'm not sure it's any less reliable than things traditional publishers do now. One thing you might watch is a site called Binge Books, which is basically a service, a website that's designed to help readers discover new books. They're going to use this to discover which ones they should be recommending. Let Marlowe make the recommendations. Here's something to think about. Book publicity has always circulated around the idea of word of mouth. You know, we used to talk about people gathering at work at the water cooler. Now it's mostly posts on Facebook or Instagram or whatnot, but it's still word of mouth. What happens if that word of mouth is generated not so much by readers, but by an artificial intelligence that's telling you what books are worth reading? You will like this book, and then what? Open the pod bay doors, Hal. I want to read. For my writing tips section, I thought I'd talk a bit about editing, since that's the issue that was just raised by this artificial intelligence program called Marlowe, which is basically an editor. I mean, some people might say it's like a beta reader for people who don't have friends or don't have a critique group or people who are more inclined to trust an artificial intelligence than a human being reader, which seems to me just the opposite of what reading is all about. You should care about what readers think. But anyway, I may have said this before, but just to be clear, everyone needs feedback. Possibly from human beings, not programs, but everybody benefits from feedback. Everyone needs an editor. One of the big mistakes people make, and this happens even sometimes to very successful authors, is they start thinking, well, I know it all, and other people just don't get it, so I'm going to ignore their feedback or just not get it in the first place. And this is such a mistake. I don't care if you're working on your first book or, like me, you're working on your 54th book. I think I may have lost count, but it's something like that. Anyway, everyone benefits from getting editorial feedback and at different stages. You may have heard people talk about different kinds of editing. Do I need a developmental edit or, a proofreading edit? Or let me just explain the difference and how all of the above can be beneficial. When people talk about a developmental edit, they're usually something that comes earlier in the process. Not before you've started, but maybe after you've done, I would say, two drafts, in my case anyway, because the first draft is just sort of getting everything down on paper, and then the second draft you start revising to try and make it coherent, make the story make sense, and that might be the time to get someone else, a separate set of eyes, somebody who didn't write the book, to come in and say, you know, this doesn't work, or the middle sags, or I don't like this character, or this character doesn't seem consistent, or whatever. The idea is to get that input while you're still revising the book, rather than 2 years later when you've worked on it so long, you're sick of it and don't want to make any more chances. Do it while there's something to actually be read, but you're still open to input. And then revise based upon that developmental edit. And most people find it makes their book many, many times better than it was before. Now, at some point when you think the book is finished, or mostly finished, whatever you want to call it, after the fifth draft, maybe, or the 10th, or the 300th, if you're writing for the first time, that's a good time to bring in beta readers, which are usually people you know, either readers, fans, if you've published before, or people in your critique group, or your best friends? Let's think about that. Because remember, your beta reader has to be someone who will actually give you some feedback, not just a pat on the back. Oh, Bill, that was wonderful. Well, thanks, but that really doesn't help. Might give me a little ego boo, but not helpful. You want people who will say, I liked this, I didn't like that, this didn't work, I don't know what the point of the scene is, and so forth. And that, too, can be invaluable. Probably beta readers aren't giving you so much to work with as a developmental edit because you're not really wanting to turn the whole thing upside down at this point. It's mostly done, but it could be better. Again, everyone benefits from this, not just first-time writers. And then you incorporate the comments from the beta readers and perhaps some other things you've thought of because you've had some more time to deal with it. Then it's time to look out for proofreaders, people who are reading. I mean, be open to anything, but primarily they're looking for boo-boos. This is not the most fun work. I think some people enjoy it, but, you know, trying to make sure your mind doesn't trick you into seeing what you think is going to be on the page, but actually see what is or isn't on the page. So you notice missing words or homophones that are misspelled in this context or whatever it is. Often what people do is form a sort of writing co-op. Do you have four or five friends who also write? So you can trade manuscripts, you know, they do it for you and then you do it for them. Because this is something everybody needs. And I said four or five for a reason, because that's about how many times somebody needs to do it before you can feel confident you've caught all the boo-boos. Here's the reality. Typos are everywhere. It's not just you. Even in traditional publishing, where books have supposedly been vetted many times over, mistakes will creep into the manuscript. But it seems to be happening more these days. Part of it's because ebook formatting is somewhat erratic even at this stage, but part of it's because people aren't proofing the way they used to. That's true at traditional publishing, and of course a lot of people who are self-publishing aren't doing it at all or aren't doing it enough, so they end up with mistake-ridden manuscripts that get published. Sometimes I hear people say, well, if there's a typo, somebody will tell me and then I'll fix it. You know, you can make changes anytime online. Really, don't do that. I mean, again, if one creeps out, don't panic. It happens to every author, but it will make your book look less professional, and you don't want that. So catch as much as you possibly can in advance, because that's how you present your excellent work in the best light. I know some of you are thinking, I don't know where I'll find five people, or I just don't like asking for favors. You know what? I don't either. I'm not comfortable with it, but this is a time where, as in so many other cases in the publishing writing process, you just need to soldier up, cowboy up, whatever your favorite cliche is, and suck it in and do it. And remember that you're going to offer to do it for them, so it's going to work out and it will make your book better. And that is the main thing. If you want more information, of course, I wrote the book Excellent Editing, which is all about the writing process, but editing can be the difference between an okay book and an excellent book. So take the time, maybe even spend a little money if necessary. But it's worth it. You've spent a lot of time on this book, so present it in its best light. let everyone know that you are a professional writer and you know what you're doing. My interview this time is with Betty Kulikowski, author of the Veritas Codex, although there's already a second book in this series in the works based on the success of the first, which only came out earlier this month, but it is a hit. When I looked this morning, it had a number one Amazon bestseller flag, you know, the coveted flags, and seems to be doing very well. Betsy told me that she had written, I'm sharing this with you for a reason, Red Sneaker Writers, had written 8 books in this series before the first was published. Well, what a monumental amount of faith in her future writing career. But man, how that's going to pay off now that she's got a first hit book out and she's already ready to continue the series for a good time into the future. I think she's a very special talent you should be keeping your eyes on, and that's why I invited her to do this podcast. Let's hear what Betsy has to say. Betsy, thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate you having me.
All right. I think you know the traditional opening question. If you could give an aspiring writer one piece of advice, what would it be?
Well, it's really hard for me to narrow it down to one, but I think this is a good one. Do something every day that gets you closer to your goals. You have to have a goal to do that, but you know, just do something every day that gets you there. It may take a while, but it's worth it.
I like that advice. You've had the goal of being a published writer for a while now, am I right?
Since I was very little. I think I wrote my first book when I was about 6 years old.
I bet a lot of people, did you say you wrote it?
Yes, I wrote a book when I was 6.
Holy smokes, I thought you were saying you knew you wanted to be. I knew I wanted to be. I don't think I'd written anything at age 6. What did you write?
It was just a little kid's picture book. I illustrated it and I bound it and I think I gave away a couple copies of it as presents.
And you copied them by hand, I'm guessing?
Mm-hmm. Yep, all with crayons.
Oh, parents must have been so proud though.
I wish I knew where any of those copies were.
Nobody's, you know, that's the only reason I know that I was writing at an early age is because my mother saved them. Not for you, not in your case.
She probably has them somewhere in an attic somewhere.
I mean, they weren't really worth saving, but mom did hang on to those.
Mom probably does have them if I know her.
So your first book has been published. How long have you been working on this?
I actually started writing the Veritas Codex. I went back and looked. It's been 8 years ago. I started writing it, and it was one of these books I decided I was going to write it for practice. I didn't really think anybody would ever read it, so I could write whatever I wanted. Anything could happen. There were no holds barred. And I just wanted that freedom and the ability to just be creative and come up with some crazy ideas and turned it into a book and a series.
Huh, that practice turned out pretty well. You've already written several books in this series, though, right?
Yeah, there's 8 that are mostly completed. 7 are actually like done. The 8th one I'm almost done with, and I've started plotting ideas for 9 and 10.
Well, for a practice book, you wrote a lot of sequels.
Yeah, I wanted to make sure I had those characters down pat. I want them to be real, and I want them to be holistic. I'm a very circular thinker. So I didn't write them all in order. I wrote a couple of them out of order.
Really?
So I changed one of them because of an idea that I got. I went back and rewrote the second half of it. And then one of them, I realized I had a long span of time between the two books. And I thought, you know, there's room in there for a little more backstory and a little more adventure. So I went back in and I just recently finished. It was actually the 8th book I wrote, but it's going to be book 4 in the series.
Wow, that shows the advantages of working ahead of publication.
Yes.
I know with my most recent Daniel Pike series, I mapped it out from the beginning to be 6 books. And what's going to happen more or less, of course, it changes when you write them. But the advantage was I could drop things in like book 2 that I knew would be important in book 5 and make it all seem like I'm better planner than I really am.
Exactly.
Where'd you get the idea for this series?
I grew up watching public television and programs like Ripley's Believe It or Not. I think one of my favorite shows growing up was In Search Of, that was hosted by Leonard Nimoy. Right. I'm a huge Trekkie. I love science fiction fantasy. I thought actually I was writing science fiction when I started the book, and turns out it was really more of a paranormal thriller. So, but I grew up watching those shows, and I like anything on the Travel Channel, the Discovery Channel, the History Channel, which I think is really ironic. There's not a lot of travel going on the Travel Channel these days. Not a lot of history going on the History Channel. I think the only one that's still actually doing what they say they're going to do is the Food Network. They still cook food.
Well, they're still cooking.
Yeah. Even but there's yeah, there's so many great, you know, travel adventure shows. And that was kind of how that started. It was kind of a mashup of some of the favorite ones that I like to watch.
Mm. So just to brief everybody, this Codex Veritas Codex series involves a television reporter, Lauren, who has a show kind of like In Search Of. Mm-hmm. And of course, to get material for the show, she has to go on great adventures looking for, well, in the first book, Bigfoot, right?
Right.
So, go ahead.
I was just going to say that's kind of where it started was, you know, I grew up in, I was an oil field brat growing up, and we lived for a while up in Seattle. So I spent some time in the Pacific Northwest. And I think that was like the first real legend I remember hearing about was Bigfoot. And so I've always had kind of a fascination with the big hairy giant. So, you know, a lot of people like to have a lot of fun with it. He's kind of a big popular thing right now in television commercials. Yes. You know, Daryl is out there. So. Smart. It was just, you know, something I love to read stories about. So it was like, that was the perfect place to start.
So this strikes me as the classic example of what I often preach in books and retreats and whatnot, write what you love. That's mm-hmm. what you're doing, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. All the books are things that I love, mysteries I want to see solved. You know, I don't know that I believe Bigfoot's really out there, but nobody's been able to prove it one way or another. And, you know, I'd like to know the answer.
I'm just remembering as you say that it didn't even occur to me that I had put Bigfoot in one of those Ben Kincaid legal thrillers, because that makes sense. I think it's Silent Justice, although I may be wrong, but I have to tell you, in my case, it was a guy in a suit, because that's what it looks like to me when I see those videos. But
exactly.
Your book goes a different direction, much more interesting direction. How'd you come up with the characters for your series?
You know, they're just kind of little mashups of people that I knew. And, you know, sometimes you just have this idea in your head of somebody. You know, I talk about my imaginary friends. When I have writer's block, it's when my imaginary friends aren't talking to me. So I have these people in my head that will come to me, and they'll come forward and they'll say, you know, this is my story and I want you to tell it. And, you know, it's a little wacky, but that's just kind of how I find some of the characters. It's, you know, it's based on somebody that I knew, or maybe a combination of people that I know. I find sometimes my husband's little habits end up on the page.
Oh, really? In the villain or what?
No, not usually. It's usually one of the good guys, you know, just the way somebody takes their coffee or, you know, what they tend to eat first on the plate. You know, those are things that I've noticed, you know, early on in my relationship with my husband when we were dating that were different and unusual to me, but have become, you know, part of our daily routine now.
Well, it's the first thing that pops into your mind, right? Because you
exactly.
see it all the time. I've got a feeling, which I could be wrong, but I kind of think your protagonist, Lauren, seems a little bit like you. Am I right about that?
Yeah, she and I have a lot of things in common. You know, when you start, you know, you tell people that you're a writer, they, oh, well, you know, they always want to know, what do you write? And I'm like, well, yeah, I write about Bigfoot. And they're like, that's nice. And so Lauren doesn't get a lot of respect for being a scientist in a field. You know, she's a biological anthropologist, but, you know, people, oh, you're just out there making money on television. You're just looking for Bigfoot. And so she doesn't get a lot of respect. And so sometimes as a writer, you think, well, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't publish right away. Is like, I wasn't sure what people would say about somebody writing, you know, stories about Bigfoot, but now I'm to a point where I don't care. I enjoy it.
There, you know, and that's the key, because if you enjoy it, I guarantee you there'll be other people who will enjoy it too. The secret, of course, is finding those people and making them aware of your book. Any tips on how to make that that sizable challenge possible?
Well, I've done a lot of research in what people are reading these days and what people believe about cryptids, and there are more people who believe in Bigfoot than believe in other things that we know to be true. And I was really fascinated when I started looking at, you know, it's more men that believe in Bigfoot, but women tend to believe more in paranormal encounters. So there's all kinds of research. There's a report that's released every year on cryptids and people's beliefs and opinions about this. And so I'm finding now that I have a tribe out there. I'm going to find them and I'm going to make friends with all of them.
That's a good plan. There's still all kinds of programming. You mentioned the History Channel and I don't know where else, but there are all kinds of shows still. I think In Search Of was the first, but it has lots of progeny programming that are investigating these kinds of mysteries.
Yeah, I saw somewhere the statistics, there's like 6,000 different movies and TV shows that deal with paranormal of some kind or another, whether it's ghosts, Bigfoot, the Loch Ness Monster, you know, the Mayan apocalypse, whatever the case may be.
Mm-hmm. And you have some special insight into the Mayan culture, having been there, right?
I did. We got to go to Chichen Itza when we were on the writer's cruise. And that was a bucket list item because book two is actually set at Chichen Itza.
Just to inform the listeners, that was the WriterCon cruise that, thank goodness, we got to do when we did, because who knows when there'll be another cruise ship going anywhere. But
exactly.
that was a great time. So what can people look forward to in the future? What's going to happen next for Lauren?
Well, you know, we're going to find some answers to some mysteries in the world. You know, I try to make sure that all my characters have an itch they can't scratch. You know, Lauren thinks she doesn't want this, and then she turns up discovering that that's really, after all, what she does want. So we have lots of adventures coming up. We've got the Mayan apocalypse is going to be episode two or book two, if you will. She has some family conflict that she's going to have to figure out a way to work through. She's got adventures where they go looking for, you know, the ruins at Easter Island. There's been a lot of new research coming out of there. There's new research that's come out just in the last week about Stonehenge. There are so many mysteries out there that Lauren and Rowan and the team are going to get a chance to explore. And I think as long as new discoveries are being made and new science is going on out there, I'll always have an idea for book X, you know, whatever the next one is.
Good. I hope so. You know, even though the Veritas Codex is your first book, you've been writing for a while. What are some of the lessons you've learned? Things you didn't know at first.
I have lots of lessons learned. The best thing you can do is have an editor. Mm-hmm. I type super fast. I the last time I took a time typing test was 145 words a minute.
Wow.
Yeah, and then I broke the program. So get an editor. And don't think that you're just Little Miss Sunshine perfect every time you write something. You know, there's always room to improve, and I'm learning that quickly. But write what you love. Mm-hmm. Write that story that you want to read. Write that book that you need to tell. And I've got a lot of them on the back burner that I hope at some point will all come forward and get published. Whether I self-publish those or whether, you know, go through a traditional publisher, I've got those stories to tell. And I like to tell the stories. I love to listen to people. I like to interview people. I like to know, you know, what's your story? What's your background? I used to sit and listen to my great uncles talk about World War II. And the only time they would ever really talk about it is if they were drinking beer. And when I was a kid, of course, that was, you know, scandalous, but they only did it when they were fishing. So I'd learned to go fishing with my uncles just so I could listen to the stories. So there's stories there that are just sitting in the back burner waiting for me to figure out how I'm going to tell the stories. Mm-hmm. So there's always something coming down the pipe.
I predict we're going to get a lot more books from you, Betsy. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
Thanks again, Betsy, for being on the podcast. Since I mentioned editing and WriterCon during this podcast, let me just remind everyone that in addition to the annual writing conference, I also offer various small group writing opportunities, writing workshops, during the course of the year. And this year, for the first time ever in December, I'm doing one online, understanding that some people are still hesitant to get out and travel much, and some of you are so far away that you might not want to travel even in the best of worlds, which this isn't. But online, everybody's right there, basically. I test drove this approach to the writing retreats during the summer, and it seemed to work really even better than I expected. I'm always going to prefer having people in the room and being able to talk to them, but this works pretty well. And in this retreats, because it's just a small group of people, 10 or fewer, usually fewer, you know, I can give everyone the one-on-one attention they deserve. I read manuscripts before it begins. I read your work every night. And everything that we do, the critique, the talks on different topics, it's all targeting the works in progress of the people in the small group workshop. So if that would interest you, visit my website, williambernhardt.com. Click on the Red Sneaker Writers tab, and you can read about not only the online workshop in December, but another one planned live and in person for next year. The most important thing, Red Sneaker Writers, of course, is that you keep writing, and one way or another, try to get some useful feedback. So until next time, keep writing, and remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit.